Hey, we're in the Genesis chapter 9, so let's open up to that. And we've been dealing with this little passage at the beginning of Genesis chapter 9. Let me put it in context for you, and I hope you all came with your homework questions done. If not, we'll be reminding you what those homework questions are all about. But yeah, in terms of which hands I'm going to recognize, I'm going to give priority to those who've done the homework, okay? So you've been forewarned. All right. Everything that lives and moves will be food for you. Just as I gave you the green plants, I now give you everything. And so this is that passage that speaks about the fact that human beings are not going to be living much so long anymore. And since they're only going to be living to a maximum of 120 years, they don't have to confine themselves to a vegetarian diet. If you're going to live to be 900, you better have a vegetarian diet. But since you're only going to be living to be a maximum 120, he now gives permission to Noah and his descendants that they can eat meat as well as the vegetables. By the way, a few of you ladies here in the class have been really questioning, is it possible to have 150 children per woman in the days before the flood? Kathy, she's not here today. She's got other things going on. But she says, Hugh, look what I found right here in the Guinness World Book of Records. You want to know what the record is for how many children a woman gave birth to where they got documents, paper documents? It's 69. Yeah. And that's the lady who didn't live to be 900. She only, I forget, she lived into her 70s. But she had 69 children. Now then, okay, to put this, I mean, you're saying, how can you be pregnant 69 times if all you do is live into your 70s? Okay, she only had 27 pregnancies. But as a result of those 27 pregnancies, she had 69 children. And so there were a lot of twins, and I think there were two sets of triplets and one set of quadruplets. This was in the 1700s in Russia, but they actually have paper documentation to back up the claim. The other thing that was really amazing to me is 67 of the 69 lived into adulthood. All 69 survived childbirth, but two of them did die when they were children. But gee, in the 1700s, that was outstanding to have only two out of 69. Well, I mean, that I think is something we've raised in this class here before, that, you know, it seems really incredulous to us who are urbanites to think about having families of that size. But, that size, pardon me. All we need to do is realize what was it like before the revolution here in America. And you want to know the average number of children each couple was having in pre-revolutionary America? It was 10. And that's really, I mean, you know, I'm from Canada, and you compare Canada to the United States. In the 1700s, the Canadian population was growing slowly. And the good reason for that, it's cold up there, and the growing season is short, and there's a limit to how many children you can sustain in that kind of a situation. And not only that, a lot of children died during the winter. Whereas in the United States, there is a tremendous population explosion, which really made it possible for the U.S. to split off from Britain. Couldn't happen in the north, but it could happen in the south because they had the population to sustain it. And hey, when you're having 10 children per couple. But what made it all possible is there was no land shortage. Likewise, in Russia in the 1700s, land was abundant. And so people were having very large families because, you know, the more children you had, the more agricultural land you could exploit and the richer you became. That was literally true. The more children you had, the wealthier you were. Whereas today, the more children you have, the poorer you are, right? So that may explain why we limit our children where people in the past did not. Children were a source of wealth. Hey, let's move on. But you must not eat meat that has lifeblood still in it. And for, I'm going to turn the page here. My pages are getting stuck together now. And for your lifeblood, I will surely demand an accounting. I will demand an accounting from every animal, and from each man too, I will demand an accounting for the life of his fellow man. Whoever sheds the blood of man, by man shall his blood be shed, for in the image of God has God made man. As for you, be fruitful and increase in number, multiply in the earth and increase upon it. And I want to focus on the sixth verse. Whoever sheds the blood of man, by man shall his blood be shed, for in the image of God has God made man. Now, it was interesting at the Friday night event, there was a young man that came to the microphone and was trying to challenge the interpretation of Fuzz and myself of the opening chapters of Genesis by saying, shouldn't we always go with the simplest literal understanding of the text? And this is an example where I think you could get into big trouble if you take the simplest, most literal understanding of the text. I mean, what is the simplest, most literal understanding of this text? You kill somebody, you're going to be killed by, you know, some other guy's going to kill you if you kill somebody. So any... You want to get real simple? Yeah. If you cut somebody else, then you get cut too. Okay. Right. Wouldn't be any doctors of that or two. Yeah, if somebody does surgery on you, you get to do surgery on him. All right. Could be rough. Could be really rough. But, you know, the response we gave to the young man is, I picked out Leviticus 13:40 and said, the text there says, if a man is bald, he is clean. Now, if you take the simplest, most literal reading of that text, you're going to get into real trouble, right? And obviously, when you read Leviticus 13, there's no guarantee there that if you're bald, you're physically clean or spiritually clean. Those of us that are bald are no less sinners than those of you who have a full head of hair. That's not what the text is talking about. And it's plenty of verses in the Bible that are in that context. But this is one of those verses where people have taken the simplest, most literal reading of the text, and I think have done damage to the rest of the Bible. I take the position that this verse is not saying that every act of murder must require the death penalty. That's how a lot of people interpret this. It says right here in Genesis 9:6, and says it in straightforward, simple, literal language, if you kill somebody, you must be killed. Now, that's one verse. We need to put it in context, just like you would with Leviticus 13:40. You don't want to pull that verse out of context and draw the wrong conclusions. Maybe we should only have bald-headed pastors and elders in the church, right? I don't know. that's not what you want to do. So, what I asked you by way of homework was this. Number one, in order to understand what God is saying in Genesis 9:6, I mean, this is a command he's giving to Noah, so it is a serious command. Number one, who can administer the justice? It says that a man sheds blood, if you murder somebody, by man, your blood should be shed. Who is that man? Who is the one that can administer the justice? Okay, and can you find some biblical support to back up your statement about who should administer that justice? We're going to give you a first chance to talk, Don, but let me throw out the other two homework questions. Okay, whoever this person is that can administer the justice for murder, what are the maximum penalties that can be invoked? Okay? Now, I want you to understand a little bit of the cultural context. There were nations around the nations of those ancient nations back in those days who, if you murdered somebody, the authorities would kill you, and they would kill your children, and they would kill your parents. Okay? So, I want you to think about, the Bible does establish a maximum penalty for murder. It establishes maximum penalties for robbery, maximum penalties for rape, and on down the line. What are those maximum penalties? Okay, the Levitical law is loaded with that. Okay, but here's a more difficult one. The Bible also establishes minimum penalties. You know, sometimes people read through the Bible and say, well, any sin can be forgiven. Doesn't exactly say that in a legal justice context. There are minimum penalties that must be invoked for the sins that we commit against one another. God can forgive us, but we need to deal with the sins we commit against one another. What does the Bible say about those minimum penalties? Don, you get to kick it off. Okay. So, if you're going to administer the death penalty, you have to have a minimum of two witnesses, preferably three, but a minimum of two witnesses. Moreover, those witnesses are to partake in the justice. Okay, but I'll ask you a question. Are they the justice? Who is it that determines that the murder has been committed and needs a penalty? Is it the witnesses? In other words, who makes up the court? Exactly. Okay, so you notice in the Levitical system, there was a Levitical law. There were priests or judges who were appointed, and these witnesses were to come to this court, this legal court, and present their case. Not always. Right. You know what's interesting, Don, and the rest of you, is this is where our founding fathers got their mandate for a Supreme Court. So you got your local court, but there's going to be a Supreme Court you can go to where the cases are too difficult. So it's interesting that our founding fathers of our nation, you know, took this and said, here's a legal system we can set up that will be the most fair for our nation. So it's not just one court. There's a court to back up the local court. But it is a court. I mean, I think what's interesting is that you see nothing within the book of Leviticus that will support a vigilante system. I mean, this is what the other nations had around them. You know, if somebody killed somebody, all the neighbors would gather around and do the equivalent of a lynch mob. There'd be no trial, no court case. There were no officials set up. If it happened, they took care of it. And basically Moses says, we're not going to do it that way. We're going to set up ahead of time a legal court system, and there will be a backup to that legal court system for the difficult cases. So no individual could go out and kill his neighbor because that neighbor had killed one of his relatives. That could not be done. Yeah. Well, let me give you kind of a legal analogy for that I think we're familiar with. Somebody commits murder, and he gets arraigned. And he is told he'll have to spend his time in jail until a court trial. Or he can set bail. Now, if he pays bail, that guarantees him protection from that kind of retribution from the neighbors. At least it's supposed to. Okay, so for example, if you go out and kill a guy who robbed your home who was on bail, you're going to get it from the authorities. We released him on bail to his own recognizance. It was a promise that he would come and submit himself to the court authority. So when you pay bail, that's what you're really doing. You're guaranteeing that you will submit to that. Now what we have here in Numbers is a system of cities of refuge. So an individual went to a city of refuge that was equivalent to his or her promise, hey, I'm going to submit to the court system. But until that gets going, in order to make sure we don't allow vigilantism to get out of hand, there's a city of refuge system. You could go there. Because it's well understood, the relatives are going to be angry. And so we need some system set up in place to protect against that. What we have here are jails and bail systems. This was their system to take care of that. Well, what you're really signaling, yeah, I mean, that's in there. And it's really a signal, hey, this guy's not prepared. I mean, if you leave the city of refuge, you're basically demonstrating by your actions, I have no intentions to submit to the authority of the court. And basically they're saying, well, if that happens, and one of the relatives decides, now it's not condoning, it's not a command to the relative, you know, if that guy jumps bail or, you know, gets outside of the city of refuge, knock him off. It's not saying that, but it says if you, in your anger, decide to do that, you're protected. And, you know, I can understand that from this perspective, hey, you know, here's this fellow is in the city of refuge. He decides to leave, and then you become concerned. Justice will not be served. And so, I think that's the context. And again, you can go back to Genesis 9:6. If you shed a man's blood, by man your blood shall be shed, and here's somebody trying to escape the justice system. Now, it's to the man's benefit to stay in the city of refuge. And I think that's part of it too, is that, look, we're really serious about you submitting yourself to the court authorities. And if you decide to, you know, look at this very flippantly, we're not going to protect you if one of the relatives knocks you off. Right. Oh, it is. Right. But I would think if I was in a city of refuge, I'd be strongly motivated to stay there, knowing that, hey, you know, it's not just the authorities that can get me, the relatives can get me too. And if I see how mad they are about what has happened, and usually that's the case, the relatives are really upset. And that should be something that keeps the arraigned murderer in check. And, you know, in one sense, it's in our country, it's too easy to jump bail. Well, in this system, it was a little more difficult to jump bail. It wasn't just the money. Your very life was at stake if you jumped bail. That's a good question. What does the Levitical law say about that? Is intent or premeditation a factor? What does it say? It's got a lot to say about that. That's right. Yeah, correct. True, but there are exceptions to that that you'll see in Scripture. For example, if the king or the priest were to decide to grant a pardon. But the king or the priest could also put conditions on the pardon. And you'll notice that both King David and King Solomon would do that for murderers. They would say, you know, you're free of the penalty, but here are certain conditions we're going to place on it. Yeah. And sometimes they said you had to confine yourself to the city of Jerusalem. And if you left the city, then you would no longer be protected. And it was up to the king or the priestly court to determine that. Okay. Yeah, well, the blood relative was never, that was never condoned, that the blood relative could go out and kill. If it happened, and under these legal conditions, it could. No, that's the relative. Right. But do notice this, the decision does not land in the hands of the relative to determine the guilt. It lies in the hands of the elders of the city of refuge. They determine the guilt, and as Don has already pointed out, there has to be a trial where at least two witnesses come forward and testify, because they won't hear it unless there's at least these two witnesses. Moreover, what I think is better than what we do in our court system is that the witnesses are held responsible. They have to testify. They also have to participate in the execution. So I'm going to be fairly serious about my testimony if I know I have to participate in the execution. You know, the whole idea, you know, we have a conscience, God's Holy Spirit's going to react on it, and hey, if I'm there and I know that my testimony is false, and by the way, there's another piece of that. What's the penalty for false testimony in our nation? Maximum is 5 years in prison. What's the penalty for perjury in the Levitical law? Death. Exactly, it's the death penalty. Now, again, I would argue it's a maximum penalty. It could be a lesser penalty. But there again, if you testify that you saw somebody kill person X, and if your testimony is later proven to be false, then you can suffer the same penalty as the one who was who had the verdict. Whatever verdict the guy had that you testified against will fall upon you. Yeah. So, I mean, if he stole a loaf of bread and, you know, had the consequences of replacing 5 loaves of bread and you were a false witness, you would have to replace those 5 loaves of bread. They couldn't kill you for that. But if it was a capital offense and the person actually was executed and your testimony was proven to be false, then the court could actually execute you. Didn't have to, but they could. And, of course, then you also had to participate in the execution. So, I think they had a lot less perjury in those days than we have in our days. I mean, look at all the perjury we have. Yeah. Top down, right? Well, I mean, this, I think, lays to the final question I got. You know, there's a reason why the Bible establishes minimum penalties for certain offenses. If you don't establish minimum penalties, then crime can get out of hand. And I would argue today, perjury is out of hand in our nation. And one reason it's out of hand is the penalty for perjury is so slight. I mean, some people get off with no penalty at all for perjury. A lot of people do. Okay. So what we see in the Levitical law is a precedent for first-degree murder and second-degree murder. You also see a precedent for manslaughter, you know, kind of an accidental death. Okay, New Testament passage. I was waiting for that. Go for it. So the New Testament squarely places the authority in the governing authority. They are the ones that can execute this justice, or at least delegate the administering of that justice. Nobody else. No room for a vigilante group to do that. It must come from the governing authority. Although, as you see in Levitical law, the governing authorities could delegate that to who they saw fit to carry out the sentence. I mean, that is really correct. In other words, say one of my relatives has been murdered. I would have the right to go to the court under the Levitical system and plead for mercy on behalf of the one who murdered my relative. But it had to come from that offended family. They were the ones that had to come and plead mercy. Yeah, I'm trying to think of some. Go ahead while I'm trying to think. And you had a question too, but go ahead. Okay. You're right. In our modern court system, circumstantial evidence would be adequate. Now, the Bible here is not saying that circumstantial evidence cannot convict someone, but what it is saying, circumstantial evidence is not adequate if it's a capital offense. Okay, if you're talking about the death penalty as an instrument of justice, then it must be more than just circumstantial evidence. But also, I think your comment is correct. Today, circumstantial evidence is much more definitive, or can be much more definitive, than circumstantial evidence could be here. Back in the Levitical era, there was no capacity for doing a DNA test on someone who is accused of rape. Today, there is. That's the equivalent. That's true. That is a witness. So the scientist comes forward and he's asked, what are the odds that it was some other man besides this man that committed the rape? But I'm just reminding you, hey, the historical context is different. They did not have available the same degree of testing that we would have today. You know, that question, what are the minimum? Okay, well, what we note in the Levitical law is an unsolved crime wasn't ignored. There was a penalty for an unsolved crime, but they realized since we can't identify who the guilty party is, nevertheless, we're going to do what we can to atone for the offense. And so there would be a blood sacrifice of an animal. The whole nation was witness to this. And what's really going on here is the whole nation is witnessing the fact that a crime did take place, and this crime deserves a response from the justice system. So unlike today, where there's no response at all, where you got an unsolved crime in the Levitical system, unsolved crime also had a justice administration take place. And by the way, if the crime ever got solved in the future, the animal sacrifice didn't count. They had to go ahead and undertake the justice. So in that sense, there was a double jeopardy. I think it's a separate issue. So, yeah, I mean, because there are sins. I mean, this is a crime we know took place. It's not like we're guessing about the crime. We actually know it took place. While mercy killing is a whole other issue, I don't think that's what this text is talking about. And, hey, we can get into that. Does the Bible support mercy killing? I think it's fairly easy to marshal the verses to the effect that it does not. And, you know, just to give you a quick response to that, what we see in the Bible is the insistence that God has counted the number of your days. Okay? He has allotted so many days for each of us, and those days are different for each one of us. But He does not appreciate us tampering with the number of days He's allotted to us. And so He expects us to live out our full allotment, and then not to shorten it. So, okay. We're out of time. Yeah, we got to get to the prayer time. So last question, then we're going to close. Well, next time I want to get into that, because throughout the Bible we see gross acts of premeditated murder where the murderer was forgiven. Okay, but I want to bring out the point that nevertheless, there was a minimum penalty exacted, even in those situations. We can go into King David, for example, and see that the prophet pronounced a penalty, nevertheless, in spite of the fact that he was forgiven the capital offense. So, let's get into that next time, and I think that's critical for wrapping up our discussion on this and moving on. Father in heaven, we want to thank you for this ninth chapter and just how packed this chapter is with insights that will help us to understand what your real purpose was for the human race and for the management of this planet. Lord, I pray too that you give each one of us opportunities during this next week to be witnesses for you. Bring people across our paths where we can be an instrument to guide them into your light, your love, your truth, and your life. In Jesus' name, amen.